Two quick announcements before the show. First of all, don't forget, if you need your continuing education for this year, go check out the Intensive Care Academy at ICU101.com. It's Brian and my other project. Tons of educational stuff, a little more formal and robust than the podcast here. And you can claim continuing education. It's probably one of the cheapest places you can get it, and we think it's good stuff. ICU101.com. Good for CME every year. Should be valid as well for nurses and most people. Second, there is a conference coming up that might be of interest to you. It's called Revive, and it's being run by the Center for Resuscitative Sciences over at Penn, which, if you don't know, is a research group that does a ton of the work in cardiac arrest and similar topics. And they have a new event. I think it's hoped to be an annual thing, but this is the first one. It's called Revive. It's based around cardiac arrest and resuscitation. It's going to be in March of next year, 2026, March 14th. So we wanted to let you know about it because it sounds cool, and we've partnered with them a little bit to try to support it. Listeners of this show are eligible for a discount to the conference. When you check out, use the code REVIVEPENN, REVIVEPENN, as in Pennsylvania. You get $75 off, which is a good deal. It's not an expensive conference. There's also a purely virtual option if you don't want to go there, although I would. There's some cool hands-on stuff. So think about it. You've got enough lead time that you should be able to get the opportunity. It's only one day. If you're anywhere in the region or willing to travel a little bit, cool event. Revive Penn, if you want a little bit of money off, go check it out. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. All right. Welcome back, everybody. It is Brandon Otto, and there is no Brian Bowling for you, unfortunately. Brian had a last-minute crisis. Maybe he can tell you about it next time. I think his refrigerator exploded or, I don't know, became sentient or something like that. But it's just going to be me and our guest today, which is good because we have a great one. So we're here with John Emil Kenny, who is a pulmonary and critical care physician who some of you may have heard of. He's been around the educational sphere online for some time. He's written over at Pulm CCM, the blog over there. He has an entire online textbook you may have come across at heartlung.org on physiology topics. So a lot of kind of useful stuff that a lot of people have encountered. But we wanted to get into some topics of fluid today and how to assess fluid responsiveness. And I want to just lead with a little bit of transparency. Generally, when we have guests on the show, it's because we had an idea for a topic and reached out to them. This one is backwards. We were actually gotten a hold of by not even Dr. Kenny, but someone from his kind of his, I guess, marketing team to talk about a product that he's involved with, which I'm sure will come up today. We actually get a fair amount of messages like this, and generally the answer is no, because generally the topic is not of any interest to us. This actually was, which is why we're all here. So I want to just be clear on the nature here. There's no money changed hands here. This is not a sponsored deal. There's no consideration for all of this. Obviously, you should probably presume that Dr. Kenny has some bias if this topic comes up. As far as I know, I do not. It's not like he sent us a product. And as I said, he's not, you know, paying for our lunch or anything like that. But just to be kind of clear on what we're talking about here. So that's that. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Kenny.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so let me just pose to you a brief tale about a patient who might be in your ICU. Let's say a 65-year-old female. She has a history of HFpEF, hypertension, and she came to the hospital with malaise, abdominal pain, weakness, some vague symptoms, but was found to be hypotensive with a fever, leukocytosis, and elevated lactate. She had some vague abdominal symptoms, and her LFTs were elevated, so someone did an ultrasound which showed a dilated common bile duct. So everyone thought she had cholangitis with resulting sepsis. She's bolused with 2 liters of isotonic crystalloid, pick your poison, and they start norepinephrine to support her blood pressure. They call IR to try to put a drain in this thing. And in the meanwhile, the resuscitation continues. Someone does a quick ultrasound exam, and the heart looks okay, pretty normal biventricular function. They look at her IVC. It's about 1.9 centimeters. It's collapsing about 40% with spontaneous breathing. The norepinephrine dose is trending up a little bit. And so the, let's say your resident asks, you know, should we give more fluid? Share with me just your general take on this sort of contentious topic, you know, fluid resuscitation and, you know, not just the shocked patient, but let's say specifically the septic patient. This is sort of one of the favorite topics in critical care. Everyone has their own perspective and their own biases, but where do you kind of come from in general?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like certainly I'm a big advocate of personalized, tailored resuscitation. Certainly using point of care ultrasound is definitely my academic bias. You know, in a situation like this, you know, there's some hypotension, there's an elevated lactate, don't know how high that lactate is. But, you know, if the patient is persistently hypotensive or if that lactate is above 4, you know, the CMS essentially mandates a bolus of a recommended 30 mLs per kilogram. And I know that that's very contentious, especially in a patient like this, because, you know, you don't really know kind of how that patient's heart especially is behaving at this moment. You know, these patients with presumably an impacted stone, you see them in the ureters, you see them in the CBD, they just get so cytokine-y, so CERSI, so hypotensive. And she's, you know, those cytokines, they affect I think in sepsis, we think of like it affecting the peripheral vasculature and leading to hypotension and venodilation, et cetera, but it also affects the myocardium. And you can very commonly have acute septic diastolic dysfunctions. And you told me she has some HFpEF to begin with. So these are the kinds of patients where you can look at their heart and see a normal looking ejection fraction, see an LV cavity banging away. But if the LV is actually quite stiff, you could preload these patients and there's a, you know, a non-zero risk of flashing somebody like this. So I don't think it's something that you just, you know, take kind of, you know, a super liberal approach and just do 30 mLs per kilogram right away. I think it's something that you do with a little bit of, you know, circumspection and certainly with the probe to help you out. When I think about giving fluids, I kind of have this framework that I teach my team, and it's just, we call it the 3 Y, the 3 Yes framework. And essentially you've got to answer 3 questions when you give fluids. There's got to be first an indication. So yes, this patient's hypotensive on norepi, elevated lactate. So certainly there's an indication of hypoperfusion that you'd want to augment stroke volume or cardiac output with some preload. So indication, first yes is there. Then the second question is it safe to give fluids? And that is really a clinical exam supplemented by ultrasound. So you're looking for that volume tolerance kind of picture. You know, are there B-lines in the lungs? Is the chest x-ray wet? Are they crackly? Do they have a big IVC? Do they have a high CVP? Do they have weeping edema? You know, if it looks unsafe to give fluids, then whether or not they're fluid responsive or not becomes a little bit moot, because the risk profile is already, you know, it's already being expressed to you that fluids might not be the right option. But if it looks safe to give fluids, if they look clear lungs, you know, collapsing IVC, low CVP, a history consistent with volume depletion, so safety, yes. Then the next question is, are fluids effective? And that is really when you're looking at whether or not the patient is moving upwards on the Starling curve or not, say with a dynamic assessment. And I think, you know, as an analogy, I think people have a hard time thinking about fluids that way. And there tends to be this sort of misconception that fluid safety and efficacy are kind of one and the same. Like if it looks safe, if the patient's volume tolerant, then they're also volume responsive. And, you know, the converse as well. But we think about this commonly in the setting of antibiotics, where we could think of piptazo or something, where a patient could have terrible anaphylaxis to it or AIN to it. So it could be very unsafe to give that patient that particular drug, but the drug could still be effective. It could kill the E. coli that's in the blood, let's say, for this patient. And the converse is also true. It can be safe to give an antibiotic. They may have no history of anaphylaxis or any adverse reaction to the antibiotic, but the antibiotic could be ineffective, i.e., you know, the E. coli growing in the blood is resistant. So we think about fluids very similarly, that you've got to do that safety check first. do they look volume overloaded? Well, then it's why are you going to pound them with more fluids? And then if it is safe, then you want to make sure it's also effective by doing a dynamic assessment to see if they're fluid responsive.
Well, let me, I guess, pose another philosophical question. Would you agree that maybe after an initial resuscitation, the most common phenotype of sepsis, ruling out the one with a concomitant cardiac issue, whether they already had that or it's induced by sepsis, most of them do not have a low cardiac output. If anything, it's often a sort of hyperdynamic state. We're not talking about a pump problem primarily. This is a primarily distributive shock. Would you agree with that?
I think it's a grab bag. I think there's a very high and misunderstood incidence of septic diastolic dysfunction where patients could have a normal stroke volume or even a high stroke volume or a high LVOT VTI if you're doing an echo. And, you know, it may look like they've got a distributive problem. It may look like they have a high cardiac output and don't necessarily, you know, need more fluids or could be benefit from fluids, but they could kind of have a cryptic septic diastolic cardiac dysfunction where giving preload to that patient could be harmful. The converse is also true. Like, paradoxically, patients with really bad LV dysfunction as a function of sepsis, you can see those patients tend to have kind of a better prognosis for kind of unclear reasons. But
in other words, if we looked in a numbers sense, let's say we put PA catheters in everyone, which of course we don't anymore. If you were to measure all these people's cardiac output or index, some of them may have, quote, normal values or maybe normal high. But even some of those, maybe if you increase that number, whether it's with fluid or something else, might be in less shock and have better perfusion.
Yeah. Yeah, they may have high values and they may or may not respond to fluids. They may have low values and they may or may not respond to fluids. I think that that's where kind of the personalization comes in. Now, if somebody's, you know, hypotensive and their stroke volume is 110 mLs and their LVOT VTI is, you know, 27 centimeters, you know, like you could make a very reasonable argument that giving that patient more fluids is not the issue, and that, you know, pressure is flow times resistance. So if pressure is low and cardiac output is high, then you know vascular resistance is low, and you could be well within your rights to start that patient on a norepi infusion or vasopressin infusion and do really well for that patient, like 100%. But I think that the important point is, like, you always wanna take a look. You wanna measure. You wanna have some sense of what stroke volume or cardiac output is before you start looking at these patients. And that could be as simple as a pulse pressure. You know, a patient who's septic, who's 90 over 70 is very different from the septic patient who's 90 over 30. You know, like, the latter case might have a normal-ish stroke volume or a high stroke volume. And that patient may be the one, and I think they're advocating for this, the Andromeda Shock 2 study, that you start with press, right, you know, and get that diastolic pressure up. If they're 90 over 70 and they're septic, narrow pulse pressure might be a low stroke volume. Then I think you have to kind of get a sense of cardiac function. You know, is it their stroke volume low because, you know, their tank is empty, or is their stroke volume low because the heart's not doing so well?
So, you know, I think for a lot of people, maybe who are less terminally online, their perspective on fluid resuscitation, and it could be in anything, but sepsis is, you know, bread and butter everywhere. It feels like giving fluid compared to other interventions like giving pressors is easier and maybe safer. It feels harmless. And in some cases, avoiding complications of other therapies, which might be as simple as having to transfer a patient to the ICU, or, you know, more serious things that we know can be associated with pressors. And if they think about complications from fluid, they're going to think about one or two things only: pulmonary edema, particularly in patients who are susceptible to it. Maybe in some select patients, more specific things like a surgical patient, you're worried about having abdominal compartment syndrome or something like that. you kind of talked about safety. Let's try to make a little more real the idea of the harms or complications of fluid, because any risk benefit consideration, you have to, you know, reflect on both sides. So what are the downsides of giving more people more fluid?
Yeah, you know, like when I was an intern, it was in the heyday of Manny Rivers, you know, the early goal directed therapy and sepsis. And so that was the 2001 New England paper that, you know, every resident had that resuscitation algorithm burned into his or her brain. And it was like CVP less than 8, you give fluids. And I had a senior resident, you know, say you give fluids to get their CVP up above 8. If they can't breathe, you intubate them, and you keep giving them fluids to get the CVP above 8, which usually happened because of the PEEP, but that's another discussion. But what was found in that study, and anecdotally as a, you know, practicing resident in the mid 2000s, was these patients would get 10 liters in 3 days, 13 liters in 3 days, 15 liters in 3 days. And they would just, you know, were we killing them? You know, I think you could make an argument that you probably tipped some older people over the edge, but you certainly were keeping them in the ICU for longer than they needed to be. You flood them, you put them into pulmonary edema, you intubate them, they're in the unit for a week, you know, they get a VAP, et cetera, they get C. diff, you know, they get a bed sore, et cetera, like, you know, I think, you know, an analogy that I was told is sort of like, you know, they have this idea, you just give fluids and then you deal with the consequences. It's like, it's just like, you know, saying that you've got good car insurance, I'm just going to drive like a maniac and crash into things and my insurance will take care of it. Well, that's one way to approach life. I think the other kind of approach is like, don't drive like a maniac to begin with, and just be judicious with your fluids and rational with your fluids, and you can avoid those downstream consequences. And I think there's pretty good literature that when you are more judicious with your fluids, when you're more thoughtful, more rational, you keep the patient off the vent longer. You more than likely reduce length of stay in the ICU. You probably reduce complications of renal insufficiency, which is paradoxical because, like, hey, like the kidneys like fluids, but there's you know, Phil Rolla, who I know very well, will tell you that, you know, if you congest the kidneys, if you increase the CVP, then you get kidney insufficiency as well. So not to mention, you know, the gut edema and ileus and anasarca and, you know, that just keep prevent patients from getting out of bed and ambulating. And, you know, I think if you're just more judicious with your fluids, then you can avoid a lot of those downstream complications. Maybe you save 12 hours in the ICU. Maybe you save 24 hours in the ICU. Maybe you prevent a VAP. But these are all, I think, righteous approaches when you're resuscitating a patient with crystalloid.
IR comes, they put in a drain, they think they got source control. We get to about, let's say, the 12th hour after they presented. Their pressor requirement is sort of stabilized, but is still ample. They're on kind of a moderate dose of norepinephrine, they're on vasopressin, they're on steroids. Their fluid balance by now is, you know, 4.5 liters, some positive, between some fluids, some medications, and so on. So your resident calls again and says, you know, he's still in a fair amount of shock. I think he might still be fluid responsive. What about now? So you kind of alluded to markers or tools we might use to try to understand if a patient is fluid responsive, and you distinguish that from the question of whether it's safe or maybe even a good idea to give them fluid, but we'll call it responsiveness at least a prerequisite for there being any benefit to fluids. What are some markers that might be useful here? I'll throw out the most basic ones. Guessing, a sort of general gestalt based on the disease, like, oh, they were bleeding or something, they were a DKA, they seem like they're dry, that sort of thing. And then a common one is sort of eyeballing the patient's IVC and making some sense of that. Do you think that there's any tools that are better than others, or at least more practical? And I guess I would distinguish practicality versus theoretical ones, because I think there are a lot of things that have been talked about that no one is actually doing on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultrasound is kind of the key differentiator in this day and age. You know, when we approach a patient like this, we've published on this framework, it's something that we call the Doppler-Starling curve, where we take the old venerable Diamond and Forrester framework that they achieved from PA catheters post-MI. and you kind of quadrant the patient. There's four options that you can be in when you're hypoperfused. And you essentially dichotomize the x-axis, which is filling pressure. So the diamond in Forrester was with a wedge, so it was above or below 18. That puts you on the x-axis. And on the y-axis, your dichotomy is based on your forward flow. So in diamond and Forrester, it was an index of, I think, 2.2 or 2.1 or something like that. But you were either like, you know, normal cardiac output, low filling pressure, quadrant one, so warm and dry, whatever that means. You were high filling pressure, normal cardiac output, so quadrant two, let's quote, warm, wet, whatever that means. And then quadrant three is, you know, low filling pressure, low cardiac output, cold, dry. And then cold, wet is the bad one that you worry about in medical school and, you know, post-MI patients that have a high filling pressure and a low cardiac output. And so what we have argued for is that you make that same phenotypic evaluation using the probe. You could use the height of the jugular venous pulse and or a CVP or, you know, or clinical, you know, plus the pulse pressure. But the important thing is to sort of get a sense of where your patient is in those four quadrants, because it does immediately imply therapy. So, you know, if this patient, if you looked at your patient and they had a big dilated IVC, it suggests a high filling pressure. So you kind of know they're either in quadrant two or quadrant four. So, you know, warm, dry or warm, wet or cold, wet. And then on the y-axis, you look to see if they're what their LVOT VTI is as a surrogate for their stroke volume. So if it's above 17 to 18 centimeters, you know, certainly if it's above 20, it's more of a normal stroke volume. They'd be in the warm wet profile. And then, you know, if they had a very low LVOT VTI and a distended IVC, they'd be in that cold wet profile. And so I think that that is a really great starting point. Now, the goal of this video game is to get to quadrant one. You and me, hopefully right now, are sitting here in quadrant one with a normal-ish LVOT VTI and a collapsing IVC, a low CVP of close to probably zero. So you kind of then have to troubleshoot, like, how do I get from the quadrant I'm in to quadrant one? And that's where the rational therapy, I think, comes in. So if you told me this, I would look at this patient and I would say, well, if you tell me they've got a dilated IVC, it's not really collapsing, and they've got an LVOT VTI of 15, well, it sounds like they're in that kind of cold, wet profile. And I'm not even going to think about giving fluids. That's telling me there's probably pump dysfunction. And I'm thinking, like, do they need an inotrope? Do they need, you know, they're on norepi vaso. Do they actually need a little more beta? Do they need some epi or DOB or, you know, something along those lines to pull that Starling curve from that low right Q4 up into that high left Q1?
Just thinking it through, the only person who would benefit from fluid would be the cold, dry patient. Because if they're warm, they're already well perfused. And if they're wet, regardless of whether they're in shock, they're not going to respond to fluid.
I like the way that you're thinking about this. I think yes, but I think that this is the asterisk, and this is where my bias comes in, that when you look at the cold dry paradigm, that Q4, so the collapsing IVC, low cardiac output, low stroke volume phenotype, that in the septic population, there is still probably a 20 to 30% fluid unresponsiveness rate that you need to account for to not just push that patient out a flat Starling curve from quadrant three out to four. And that is kind of where the Manny Rivers paradigm broke down, because implicit in the Manny Rivers paradigm was that if you had a low CVP, so you were in that, you know, Q3, then you would respond to fluids. You would have an upright Starling curve. But in sepsis, all bets are off. And there's a fair amount of patients that have a depressed Starling curve, but who also are venodilated or maybe a little volume down. So they have actually a lowish filling pressure. They may have a CVP of 5. You know, it could be a collapsing IVC, lowish CVP. And they may have a stroke volume or LVOT VTI of, you know, 13 centimeters or, you know, 40 mLs or something like that. And you're thinking, oh, they just need fluids. They've, you know, the tank is empty. But there's probably 1 in 5 to 1 in 3 patients in that Doppler phenotype that you're actually just going to shoot them out along the Starling curve further. You're going to shoot them out to quadrant 4. And if you start to see that repeatedly, then that patient probably needs more beta is kind of like how I would approach the situation.
Well, right. And that seems like it would apply to any of the tools you're using to try to place these patients, because you're relying on some kind of cutoff within some kind of device. But whatever you're calling a high, low, or normal VTI, if that's what you're using, whatever you're calling a high, low, or normal CVP or size of the IVC or VEXIS or whatever you're using, those may or may not map to the question that we're trying to ask, which is, will the patient actually not even just increase their cardiac output, but clinically have a meaningful response to more fluids? I mean, you yourself said, whatever we call a normal cardiac output, I mean, who's to say that more might not be better in someone like this, or maybe low is okay?
Yeah, you know, I think like kind of the more is better, I think, was kind of litigated in the 80s with the studies of Schumacher, like the supernormal oxygen delivery. It didn't really pan out. But I think, you know, what intrinsically what I like about quadranting the patients is that, you know, you know exactly what it's like at the bedside. You got a zillion things going on. There's a zillion numbers you got to look at. You got three other patients that are crashing. It's like, how do I just break it down quickly for this patient right now? It's the human brain can dichotomize on the x-axis and dichotomize on the y-axis pretty well. It's like 1 of 4. And then it kind of suggests where you need to go. If you are thinking about giving fluid, so exactly as you say, if you're in that quadrant three, you know, my bias, and I think that the literature generally supports this, is to do a dynamic assessment to see if they're actually going up to quadrant one, or am I just shooting them out to quadrant four?
So rather than just trying to eyeball one thing, give them some kind of a challenge to actually see what happens.
See where they're going.
What do you think works well for that? Because people, again, have talked about many things. Everyone talks about passive leg raises, and then no one wants to bother to do it. There's various devices. Realistically, what I think most people are doing is giving a little fluid and then seeing if the blood pressure gets better.
I mean, there's no, I would say to that latter point, there's no fault in doing kind of a fluid challenge and seeing directionally which way they go. The problem with blood pressure is that it has a very poor sensitivity for knowing if you've actually augmented cardiac output or not. The specificity of pulse pressure, at least, is reasonable, but it's not perfect. But there's a very large fraction of septic patients in whom you give fluids whose cardiac output actually increases significantly, but MAP or pulse pressure doesn't really. And in those situations, you're sort of left with this conundrum of like, did the fluids not actually help? Or did they actually help and maybe they need a little bit more? I'm going in the right direction and I don't know. And that's why I think flow monitoring is so important, to actually know that you've augmented what's coming out of the left heart with an LVOT VTI or, you know, other Doppler systems, my commercial bias notwithstanding, that you're at least using arterial Doppler specifically to infer an increase in left ventricular output. Because I'm sure you've been in multiple situations where you've had a MAP of 52 and you've given, you could imagine two patients with a MAP of 52. One patient you give fluids to, if you measured flow and you knew that flow didn't change and their MAPs went to 53, versus another patient with a MAP of 52 and their MAP went to 53, but their flow went up by 30% after that preload challenge. Like, I guess the question is like, would that change how you think about that patient? Would that change how you manage the patient?
Some people would say, I'll just go and trend their LVOT VTI. Usually my answer is, but will you really? I mean, it's burdensome.
Yeah.
Is that the main downside? I know there was at least one device floating around that would try to do this continuously, but it's challenging. Some people, even just getting a spot view of this measurement is hard, and then doing it, whatever, I don't know what, 5 times a day? I don't know what you would have to do for this to be a meaningful monitoring tool.
It's hard. I mean, it was the genesis of you know, the commercial device that my company is working on for sure. Like, I just got tired of doing LVOT VTIs. So one of the device that you might be talking about is called the USCOM device. I think it's a suprasternal notch continuous wave Doppler. It's based out of Australia. And I really like that idea. You just sort of sit it in the suprasternal notch. It looks down and actually gets an ascending aortic VTI, but it helps you kind of non-invasively determine whether or not the VTI is going up or not. The device that we build sits on the neck. It makes an inference from the duration of systole from the carotid artery, but it's the same idea. Like, I want to give fluids and I want to know if MAP isn't changing, is flow going up or not? You know, because that helps me think about the patient. And if the patient's MAP isn't changing and their flow is just spot on, like delta zero, then it's like, oh, this patient needs either DAWB or, you know, beta or alpha or some combination of the two. If I'm seeing their MAP is going 52 to 54, 55, but they're having these big augmentations in volumetric output, I might try and squeeze a little bit more out of them because their pump has the ability to effectively deal with it before I jump to press to prevent the downstream potential complications of overpress. If that makes sense.
Okay. Well, I don't want to tease people too much. So, I mean, tell me about your device. What's it called? What's it look like? What's the principle?
Sure. So thanks. It's a wireless wearable continuous wave Doppler ultrasound. It sticks over the neck. It shoots to an iPad. It measures the...
So it's a patch, literally. You just stick it on the skin, attaches to nothing.
It's literally an ultrasound patch, attaches to nothing but the patient, shoots to an iPad, and then... For more sophisticated users, the nice thing about the device, the neurovascular bundle there, is that it's insinuating the jugular vein. And so you get a mini VEXUS. I know it's not part of the VEXUS, but I bug Corbin and Phil about this, why the jugular wasn't part of the VEXUS, but the physiology is exactly the same as the hepatic vein, intrarenal vein, portal vein. That the more pulsatile the jugular is, the more chunky the right atrium is, the more congested the right atrium is. So the device kind of gives you where you are on that x-axis, that you know, low filling, high filling. It points you in that direction.
And then so we're looking at the jugular vein or the carotid artery?
So jugular vein, internal jugular vein, and the carotid artery simultaneously. So the spectrogram gives you both because it's a continuous wave system. And then it measures actually delta changes in the carotid artery. So the neat thing about the device is that you can sort of think of it as it sits on the neck and it's simultaneously looking down at the right heart and the left heart, you know, the right heart through the jugular vein, the left heart through the common carotid artery concurrently. So you could give a preload challenge and you could see like where they're moving on that x-axis, or is their jugular just getting very congested and the carotid is having very little delta on the y? So then you know you've got a flat Starling curve slope versus you give a preload challenge and the internal jugular changes very little in its morphology, doesn't get pulsatile at all, and you have this big delta in the y-axis from the carotid, well, then you know you've got a very efficient heart and that it's liking the preload or at least handling the preload safely and effectively. That's
so
the genesis of the device.
To connect this to applications people might be more familiar with, if you were to do something similar using normal tools, this would be applying probably a high-frequency probe to the neck in like a cross-sectional transverse view where you saw both the jugular and the carotid, and then putting probably pulsed wave Doppler over each one,
exactly,
getting a spectral tracing, and then measuring the change in the peak velocities over time.
Yeah, so in the jugular, it just gives you the Doppler spectrograms. There's no image. I just want to be clear. So you don't see the jugular, you don't see the carotid. You just see the waveforms in the jugular and the carotid concurrently. So if you did a preload challenge, you would see the S and the D waves evolve, or the S get less than the D wave, or they become a monophasic D wave as the right atrium fills up. And then that is a qualitative clinician assessment. Like, we don't...
So this is like watching a CVP tracing, essentially.
Yeah, exactly. But you watch it in real time. And when you do a leg raise or a Trendelenburg or you have a rapid preload challenge, you actually, it's quite neat. You see the venous Doppler change in real time as the right atrium fills. And then, but what the device actually does is it measures a delta output from the carotid artery that is an inference of that stroke volume. So it's telling you if that stroke volume is going up or not.
So it's deriving a volume by using the velocity over time?
So good question. We measure the velocity time integral of the carotid, but the measure that we defer to, because it has a much better evidence base, is actually just the duration of systole, the flow time. And probably there's been a number of papers on the flow time, actually over 80 years or so, but probably the best paper in the last 10 years came out of UCLA by the intensivist group there that used handheld carotid measurements to look at the flow time and compared it to bioreactants. But like for people that are familiar with Doppler, the time of systole is like the when you get that VTI out of the left ventricle.
It's like how long from the start to the end of ejection.
Exactly. But it's like the stroke distance, the VTI, is the area of that triangle. And the area of a triangle is base times height divided by 2, right? So what we're telling you is the base and how that base is changing in response to
because the height, the velocity doesn't seem to be as important, or at least is not as well evidence-based.
Phenomenal question. When you give preload, the increase in the stroke distance tends to express itself in the time domain rather than the velocity domain. So the flow time is really germane for that preload change. Changes in afterload and contractility will express it in the velocity domain, the height of that triangle. So predicated on time as a surrogate for distance, you need to infer that afterload and contractility are pretty constant, which is a fair assumption when you're giving a rapid preload challenge or doing a leg raise or Trendelenburg. Like afterload and contractility are pretty constant. And so that increase in the time domain, the base of the LVOT triangle, can be used to infer the increase in the distance. Now, if I were to like start a patient on DOB or EPI, when you start increasing that contractility, then the time and the distance, the area of that triangle, can dissociate. So it is not recommended or fully validated in situations where you're significantly changing chronotropy or afterload.
Okay, but within fixed conditions of the heart, duration is something you can trend. If in the interim something else changed, like somebody added on an inotrope, maybe you can't trend that, but now maybe you have a new baseline.
Yes. So yeah, the goal is sort of like, you activate the device on the iPad, you collect a 30-second baseline, the ventilator's the same, the vasoactive infusions are the same, you do a Trendelenburg, right? You recruit that venous blood for 2 minutes, maybe 2.5 minutes. You look at that change in the jugular, you look at the change in the carotid artery, you get a sense of what the slope of the Starling curve is at that moment, and then you make your decision, and then the device goes to sleep.
Oh, okay, yeah. So wait, let's operationalize it. So somebody walks in the room, what data is on the screen?
Oh, you walk into the room, the device is on the patient's neck, and it's actually asleep.
Okay, so it's not a continuous monitoring tool. You tell it when you want to make, it's like shooting numbers on a swan.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of colloquially call it wearable point of care ultrasound. It's like walking in with the probe to do an assessment, but it's supposed to like allow anyone to do it, and it's supposed to give you a VEXAS and a VTI at the same time.
Okay, yeah. So then you tell it you want to do a measurement, and then you do like a leg raise. You put them in Trendelenburg.
Or you could do a rapid fluid challenge. You could. 250, 300 mLs over a couple minutes. Like it's got to be a good squeeze. It usually requires a pressure bag or a large bore with gravity, but it's not this kind of like 9999 kind of nonsense. Sure. Like you really got to do a stretch the myocytes and see what develops.
Okay. And then what is it reporting to you?
So the qualitatively, it shows you that, the pre-post, and then it shows you the jugular changes, and it shows you the delta flow time. So that you're looking for the augmentation in the base of that LVOT VTI triangle.
Like it's like a percentage change?
So it can do that, but what we quote is that paper from my former colleague Igor's group at UCLA, where they found that an increase in 7 milliseconds was the optimal threshold for detecting a 10% stroke volume change. We've recently published comparing the same thing to a TEE LVOT VTI, and we found very, very similar thresholds to Igor in terms of an increase in absolute flow time. As a very good marker of an increase in LVOT VTI.
Okay, so if your goal is to increase the cardiac output or the stroke volume and hence the cardiac output by about 10%, and I would imagine that cut off just because that's often what the literature is used as the definition of fluid responsiveness, then that seems to be indicated by an increase in that systolic, that ejection time of, what, 0.7 seconds, you said? Okay.
Yeah, 7 milliseconds. And yeah, like we could talk about the definition of fluid response. I'd love to talk about that. I mean, it's just like that 10 to 15% augmentation is just the precision of essentially thermodilution. You know, it just was like the precision of the gold standard utensil. So like a change of more than 10 to 15% meant that it was kind of real, and less than that was just kind of wobble around the baseline. So that's, okay. there's no mammalian cardiac truth in that 10 to 15% number. It's just like, oh, there was a significant change, right, you know, okay, based on thermodilution.
And so that's from the arterial side. And then from the venous side, it's just showing you the waveform before and after, if that's of use to you, and all the people who can't interpret CVP waveforms will ignore it.
Yeah, we're working on automating an interpretation using AI, et cetera, but for now it's just for the Corbin Haycocks and the Phil Rollas of the world to look at it and say, oh, like, you know, like the D wave is really big now. The right atrium is probably angry.
Yeah, because this is much like if you had looked at the IVC or the hepatic veins and got 100%. A tracing from there. I mean, you're above the heart, not below it, but same sort of vibe.
100%.
Okay.
100%.
What are the caveats here? I would imagine it depends on the patient's position. Like if you're intentionally putting them in intranalar, but if you, let's say, challenge them with fluid while they're sitting up versus laying flat, I feel like they would have different performance characteristics.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we see it regularly, is that when you give a 300 ml crystalloid infusion with the patient in the upright position, the changes in the jugular morphology are very subtle. And I think that's a consequence of it being, as you mentioned, gravitationally above the heart, but also just like small crystalloid challenges lead to relatively small changes in right atrial filling. When you do a passive leg raise or a Trendelenburg, you really see the morphological changes in the right atrium. So when the device is, as you've scanned a jugular vein with a B mode, you know that there's a collapse point, that so-called wine bottle. And when the device is above the collapse point of the jugular vein, you get this very kind of high velocity washed out Doppler morphology that is kind of lightly undulating, but it's
any flow.
It's more like kind of like imagine putting your thumb over the end of a hose and it just is this high velocity wash. Like that's kind of the pattern you see in the jugular when the device is above that collapse point. So when you see that pattern, you know that the CVP is like less than the height of the device above the right atrium. I'm not advocating that people actually measure it and calculate it, but you could if you're kind of a dork. When you lay flat and you get that rush of venous blood into the right atrium, you immediately see the CVP trace in the jugular. You see the X descent creating the S wave, you see the V wave, and then you see the Y descent creating the D wave. And in healthy people, an S greater than D in the supine position is totally normal.
Any other caveats or contraindications? I mean, a lot of these non-invasive devices will have a laundry list of times when they don't think you should use it, or at least the company doesn't recommend that, hasn't been validated or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, like any ultrasound device, it's if it's garbage in, it's garbage out, right? So it's not a monitor in that sense. It's you're like a mini sonographer. So if you have a crummy window and you've got a crummy spectrogram and you've got crummy, the device will say like, hey, it's, you know, like the bars that come up that represent every heartbeat will be missing. You'll say, oh, this is bad. Like it's not good. So a patient who's thrashing, screaming, you have to imagine ultrasound as being like a super, super sensitive stethoscope. It's literally listening for the movement of PRBCs. If you could imagine putting a stethoscope on somebody and they're screaming because they're delirious, you're not going to hear lung sounds. You're definitely not going to hear red blood cells moving in the carotid. So that's like the key patient population where it doesn't work. Where time diverges from distance, its change as a measure of delta SV, kind of mentioned some of them already, like significant changes in inotropy or afterload during that intervention. or across time will make that less true. And then certainly like patients with like really severe mitral regurgitation or severe aortic stenosis, where you could have more of that LV ejection going back up into the left atrium rather than out the aortic valve, then that relationship between time and output is degraded. You could say, well, the patient's acting as their own baseline because it's you get a baseline and a delta. But you know, if more of that ejection is going back out into the left atrium because of severe MR, then that time will be a problem as a LVOTV guy.
I assume it doesn't work if their flow is not pulsatile, like they're on ECMO and they're not doing any of their own work.
It's a phenomenal question. We have a case series in LVAD patients, and we are able to detect changes in RPMs.
So I guess it's still flow, right? So if there's an increase in their baseline, like laminar flow, it should be detectable. Just no time is not.
Yeah. When you turn up when the RPMs are high, you just see this wash in the carotid. And as you give the LV more of the work, you start to see these little shark fins like appear over the wash, and it sort of becomes more pulsatile. But in terms of like a marker of delta stroke volume, no, it won't work for sure.
So, I mean, is this imagine error / specifically being marketed for the septic patient, like I described, or could it have a role in, you know, various other shock states or, you know, fluid management situations?
Yeah, another really good question. I think that the most of the questions come from these kind of surgery septic-y patients or the undifferentiated patients where you don't really know what's like if it's like those rare times when it's just clearly cardiogenic, like is fluids really being debated, or if it's like they're clearly having a GI bleed, you know, like we're not going to check for fluid responsiveness if you're exsanguinating. You just need source control and you need blood. You know, really severe DKA is another situation that we've seen where patients come in so dry, and their electrolytes are so bonkers, their pH is so low, their glucose is so high, that these patients can be fluid unresponsive at the very beginning, and you give them liters of crystalloid, you fill up their venous beds, you actually start to prime the pump, and you change their electrolyte milieu, you get their pH up, their potassium right, and their glucose down, and then the heart starts becoming fluid responsive. So it's one of those situations where, you know, when it is a known etiology with a clear therapy, you know, fluids, insulin, blood, you know, thrombolytics, if it's a big PE, like it's not exactly the right thing to use per se.
Well, even an exsanguinating patient, I mean, a not uncommon situation in a big bleed is that they're obviously hypovolemic. At some point they stop bleeding, and then it's not always obvious when they're no longer hypovolemic and you need to stop pumping blood into them. So I guess I can imagine you pop up a monitor and then it's at some point it says, hey, this is not doing anything anymore. Maybe if they're hypotensive, it's just distributive or some other whole thing you're missing.
For sure. 100%. Like if you've got, you know, source control, if you know the bleeding has stopped and you're sort of in this in between undifferentiated state, then it's the device to use. Like I kind of say, like, if you're thinking about if you're a POCUS person and you're thinking about picking up the probe, well, you know, this is kind of like, you could think about picking up this device as well. It's those situations when you're just not sure.
Couple practical things. What does it cost? How long do you leave it on?
Cost? That's a, you know.
I know cost in healthcare is all sort of made up and the rules don't matter, but can you give us some rough sense? Like,
yeah, I mean, I would say that you know, we are priced very comparably to the other reusable stick-on devices, whether it's the finger cuff device or the bioreactants pads. You know, we are right in line with that. And so that between different institutions, that's kind of anywhere between, you know, $300 and $500. You know, I think central lines.
So it is a reusable device between patients.
It is a repurposable. So it's a one device use, and then you send it back to us. We give you actually a rebate if you send it back, so we can repurpose it, recycle it, and stay green. So we're not just throwing away ultrasounds. But you know, like it is this, you know, the diplomatic part of me is it's the same price as other reusable stick-ons, and it's actually cheaper than most invasive catheters per patient.
How long can you leave it on there?
So the adhesive it's stuck on there should be taken off and replaced every 24 hours. And that's just to look for skin breakdown, et cetera, et cetera. The device itself gets you about 100 assessments with the battery life. So you can keep it on.
And it's not chargeable once the battery is out, it's done.
Correct. So the you know, you could keep it on the patient for 2 weeks if you wanted, if you were, you know, doing that daily skin check and you were below that kind of 100 assessment mark.
Switch side to the neck every day or something like that.
Yeah, exactly.
How do you see this in application and pros and cons compared to other non-invasive cardiac output monitors? And I feel like the most common that are out there are the ones that use an arterial line tracing, whether a stroke volume variation or pulse pressure variation, to say something much like you're describing here. Of course, a whole different technology, but this is just kind of going about a different way. Do you think there are upsides to this? It's just kind of a different approach.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, the other technologies are great. And, I love it when I walk into a hospital and I see them using some sort of flow guidance for their resuscitation. That to me suggests, you know, a progressive, you know, thoughtful institution. And if, you know, God bless you, if you're using, you know, an A-line based device, you know, the kind of the obvious answer is like, if you're using Doppler ultrasound with a probe, our device, it is a direct measure of flow velocity. If you're using a pressure waveform, then you are using anthropometric, or you could calibrate it if you've got, you know, the Pico device, but you're using some sort of, you know, transformation to go from pressure to flow. And that can become problematic when there's significant changes in peripheral resistance or peripheral compliance. So some of the devices that measure pressure and infer flow do have problems when there's, you know, significant vasoactive infusions. Whereas, you know, a direct measure of flow over a major artery is much more robust to that. You know, and then there's just the other obvious, I think, answer is that it's just a stick-on ultrasound. You know, like ambulance, ED, like you don't need to put an A-line in. You know, if you've got a good BP cuff and you've got, you know, a way to measure changes in Doppler ultrasound in an artery, then you kind of have, you know, a mini ICU at your fingertips, and you could do that almost anywhere. You know, the nice thing is that it has other kind of applications of like in rapid response. You could very easily bring it to the bedside on the floor. You know, we've got at least one case report and a data set for ROSC detection and CPR. So it's kind of got like these other peripheral applications that are really nice. But that's kind of, you know, my bias. But that's grounded in my bias in point of care ultrasound, which is how I trained.
So let me, as we kind of wrap up, I don't want to be difficult, but let me kind of pose the devil's advocate position, because I think a lot of the audience may have a similar thought and say, look, maybe there are other niche applications, but imagine the septic patient. Yes, it's not great when they get too much fluid. But let's say a patient who 20 years ago would have gotten 10 liters of fluid in the first day. Now it's 2025, times have changed. Maybe they get 5 liters. You go and give them a 15-minute spiel trying to reify the implications of volume overload like we just did, and they say, oh, okay, now this resident is only give that patient 3 liters. The room for benefit, if we're talking about fluid stewardship, is sort of on the slim side in that kind of middle of the bell curve person when we're talking about sepsis, a disease that is not primarily a volume problem. Now, you can say this person, I can increase their cardiac output by 10%. That person, I couldn't. But the you know, professor of therapeutic nihilism says, I'm not convinced that increasing this septic person's cardiac output by 10% matters. I don't think their cardiac output was their problem. They were vasodilated. Even if I double their cardiac output, I think most of their problem after their initial resuscitation, when they're not like overtly having poor macrocirculatory flow, is more in their microcirculation, and it's more kind of cellular and cytokines and whatnot. So if a change that's so small that you need a Doppler to detect it, I don't think is going to be clinically significant. Because we're already kind of a few steps away from what I think the central problem is here. So, you know, it's day one. They've had a handful of leaders. Most of these people, I think, were playing in a realm of, you know, are they going to end up with another leader on board or another half a leader or not? And maybe that matters, but how much? What would you say to an argument like that, where a lot of this is sort of, I don't want to say academic, but it's the room for changing care and moving the needle doesn't seem all that much, you know, assuming you're coming from a pretest probability and kind of a modern sense of being somewhat reasonable about fluid management.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very valid and appropriate question. I don't think you're being difficult. I think it's, you know, I agree with your proposition that, you know, augmenting cardiac output is, you know, is that going to make a difference? For me, I see the real value in the earlier breaks. It's stopping the patient from getting crystalloid, who is unresponsive, but cryptically unresponsive, because it's that patient that whose MAP goes from 52 to 54 on the first liter, and then 53 to 55 on the second liter, and then 52 to 56 on the third liter overnight. And then it's, you know, the 70-year-old guy who's got a little bit of a brewing, you know, HFpEF from septic cytokines, and also a former smoker, and now is on BiPAP and in the step down because he got that extra liter and a half that he didn't need. And then he's on the BiPAP and he's got a dry mouth and he gets delirious and he's screaming, and he pulls it off and he falls and he's got a head CT and a brain. Like, I think, you know, that is an anecdote, but I think that you've probably encountered patients like that. And so I don't think it's an unusual anecdote. And I think at the population level, like when you think about the arguments between balanced and isotonic saline, there was lots of, you know, parsing out the SALT trial, and it was these small effects. But if we're giving 2 million liters of crystalloid every year, then it, at the population level, it matters. And I think you could make a similar argument like that. Like, you know, by doing this, are you saving every patient's life? No, for sure not. But are you saving maybe 12 hours in the ICU? Are you saving maybe 8 hours in the ICU if you rationally withhold that additional 1.5 to 2 liters that they weren't responding to? If you did that in 10%, 20% of septic patients you're resuscitating, just as you said, sepsis is so common at the population level, you know, a really rational approach to fluids could save, you know, many days of precious ICU beds. And ostensibly, if you're reducing those sort of add-on downstream consequences that we see frequently in the elderly population, you know, like there is a benefit to it, I think. I think that there's good literature that supports that. It is mixed. I will be the first to fully acknowledge that. But at least, you know, one well done randomized trial that showed that, you know, when you look for fluid responsiveness, you give less fluids and you have fewer complications. And I think it's those patients that have the low CVP, the collapsing IVC, that are unresponsive, that kind of get that extra 2 liters that they might not have needed, that maybe prolongs their care in the hospital for an extra hours or days that could be quite beneficial in aggregate.
Yeah, and I just to hedge my own skepticism, the times when I think about something like a cardiac output monitoring device in a septic patient, which is certainly not every day, is generally, as we kind of mentioned, more complex pictures, mixed shock states. They're septic, but they're also in cardiogenic shock or something along those lines. And then having some way to give you data, and that's even, you know, even occasionally maybe a PA catheter, those situations may even make more sense, because it can be so hard to parse out what is purely a matter of, you know, vasomotor tone versus maybe you can augment the flow in some other way.
even bread and butter sepsis, there's very frequently a mixed picture. You know, even in young, healthy people, you can get these subtle diastolic dysfunctions. Now, am I saying like, you know, do we need to be super aggressive with, you know, flow monitoring in 35-year-olds with urosepsis? Like, I've seen cases where it would have mattered. There's probably lots of cases where you don't need to be, you know, super precise with your fluid management. But it's just like, it's kind of common that shock is, especially in sepsis, is frequently some kind of mixed picture. Like the myocardium's never perfect in a really bad, like this case that you described with the, they're just going to be so cytokine-y and the heart's going to be pissed off in some way, shape or form.
Yeah. And perhaps we should emphasize also that the fact that somebody's stroke volume increased by 10% doesn't mean that you should give them more fluid. It is 100%. Just probably a prerequisite for it, such that if it doesn't, then you probably should not. Doesn't mean that increasing it 10% is going to help them or help them in a meaningful way. Doesn't mean that that increase will sustain over any amount of time. Doesn't mean that the harm is worth the benefit and so on and so forth. But if it doesn't increase at all, it's hard to imagine how it would be good unless you have some whole other goal like increasing renal filtration or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why, like I said at the outset, we have this very structured approach. Indication, yes, there's got to be an indication to augment stroke volume first. If there is no indication, then who cares if they're fluid responsive? Indication, yes. Safety, yes. They're not overloaded clinically or ultrasonographically, low VEXAS, et cetera, et cetera. Safety, yes. And then the third question is it effective? And that's when you want to see if you're engaging your Starling curve or not.
And if anyone's listening to this and they're like, my God, this is exactly what I need, give me 100, what, just Google flow patch and they'll find your website?
I'm a bad salesman. Yeah, I guess it would be flowsonicsmedical.com. Or you can find me at heart-lung.org and send me an email through that site and I'll direct you to the appropriate person.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Rest of you guys, we'll talk to you next time.